RIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Juliet Hart quit her job last summer as an oceanographer for the United States Geological Survey, where she used climate models to help coastal communities plan for rising seas. She was demoralized after 4 years of the Trump administration, she said, in which political appointees pressured her to delete or downplay mentions of climate change. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Coral Davenport, Lisa Friedman, and Christopher Flavelle. The piece is titled, A Brain Drain Among Government Scientists Bogs Down Biden's Climate Ambitions. Stay with us for more. Juliet Hart quit her job last summer as an oceanographer for the United States Geological Survey, where she used climate models to help coastal communities plan for rising seas. She was demoralized after 4 years of the Trump administration, she said, in which political appointees pressured her to delete or downplay mentions of climate change. It's easy and quick to leave government, not so quick for government to regain the talent, said Dr. Hart, whose job remains vacant. President Donald J. Trump's battle against climate science, his appointees undermined federal studies, fired scientists, and drove many experts to quit or retire, continues to reverberate 6 months into the Biden administration. From the Agriculture Department to the Pentagon to the National Park Service, hundreds of jobs in climate and environmental science across the U.S. federal government remain vacant. Scientists and climate policy experts who quit have not returned. Recruitment is suffering, according to federal employees, as government science jobs are no longer viewed as insulated from politics, and money from Congress to replenish the ranks could be years away. The result is that President Biden's ambitions, plans to confront climate change are hampered by a brain drain. The attacks on science have a much longer lifetime than just the lifetime of the Trump administration, said John Holdren, professor of environmental science and policy at Harvard University and a top science advisor to President Barack Obama during his 2 terms. At the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, new climate rules and clean air regulations ordered by President Biden could be held up for months or even years, according to interviews with 10 current and former EPA climate policy staff members. The Interior Department has lost scientists who study the impacts of drought, heat waves, and rising seas caused by warming planet. The Agriculture Department has lost economists who study the impact of climate change on the food supply. The U.S. Energy Department has a shortage of experts who design efficiency standards for appliances like dishwashers and refrigerators to reduce the pollution they emit. And at the U.S. Defense Department, the Pentagon, an analysis of the risk to national security from global warming was not completed by its original May deadline, which was extended for 60 days, an agency spokesman confirmed. President Biden's plans to curb greenhouse gas emissions depend on Congress to pass legislation, but a good portion could be accomplished by the executive branch if the president had the staff and the resources. While the Biden administration has installed more than 200 political appointees across the government in senior positions focused on climate and the environment, even supporters say it has been slow to rehire the senior scientists and policy experts who translate research and data into policy and regulations. White House officials said the Biden administration had nominated more than twice as many senior scientists and science policy officials as the Trump administration had by this time, and was moving to fill dozens of vacancies on federal boards and commissions. It has also created climate change positions in agencies that didn't previously have them, like the Health and Human Services Department or the Treasury Department. The administration has been very clear about marshalling an all-of-government approach that makes climate change a critical piece of our domestic national security and foreign policy, and we continue to move swiftly to fill out science roles in the administration to ensure that science, truth and discovery have a place in the government again, a spokesman, Vedant Patel, said in a statement. During the Donald Trump years, the number of scientists and technical experts at the United States Geological Survey, an agency of the Interior Department and one of the nation's premier climate science research institutions, fell to 3,152 in 2020, from 3,434 in 2016, a loss of about 8%. Two agencies within the Agriculture Department that produce climate research to help farmers lost 75% of their employees after the Trump administration relocated their offices in 2019 from Washington to Kansas City, Missouri, according to a study by the Union of Concerned Scientists, an environmental group. And at the Environment Protection Agency, EPA, the number of environmental protection specialists dropped to 1,630 from 2,152, a 24% decline, according to a House Science Committee report, which called the losses a blow to the heart of the agency. The Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, is operating under its Trump-era budget of about $9 billion, which pays for 14,172 employees. Joe Biden has asked Congress to increase that to $11.2 billion. At the same time, President Biden has directed the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, to write ambitious new rules, reining in climate warming pollution from vehicle tailpipes, power plants and oil and gas wells, while also restoring Obama-era rules on toxic mercury pollution and wetlands protection. Some EPA scientists are facing a mountain of work that was left untouched by the Trump administration. One program, the Integrated Risk Information System, or IRIS, evaluates the dangers of chemicals to human health. During the Obama administration, the program completed studies on the effects of 31 potentially harmful chemicals. During the Trump administration, the program completed just one, on RDX, a toxic chemical explosive used in military operations. There is a massive backlog, said Vincent Cogliano, a former head of the Risk Information System, who retired in 2019. A lot of people have left, and that will make it harder. The problem is made worse by a fleeing among young scientists, that federal research can be derailed by politics. My students have told me I believe in what EPA is trying to do, but I'm worried that the outcome of my work will be dictated by the political leaders and not by what the science actually says, said Stan Myberg, who directs graduate studies in sustainability at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. He left his 38-year career at the Environmental Protection Agency the day before Donald Trump's inauguration. The U.S. Geological Survey lost hundreds of scientists during the tenure of James Riley, a former astronaut and petroleum geologist appointed to be director by Donald Trump. James Riley sought to limit the scientific data that was used in modeling the future impact of climate change. What I saw under the Trump administration, and particularly under Director James Riley, was a perfect storm, a situation where there was interference with the science, inefficient micromanagement that bogged us down, and also negligence of key missions, said Mark Sogg, a former research ecologist with the agency who retired in January after filing a complaint against James Riley. Were there long-term effects? Mr. Sogg said. I think so. Many of those projects are still behind and struggling. Another author of the complaint against James Riley, David Applegate, a longtime scientist at the U.S. Geological Survey, has been appointed the acting director of the agency. Joe Biden has requested that Congress increase its budget to $1.6 billion from $1.3 billion, and the agency has hired nearly 100 scientists under Dr. Applegate's direction. But still, vacancies abound. As a research scientist at the Geological Survey, Margaret Heiser-Redsteer ran the Navajo Land Use Planning Project, which studied climate change to help tribal officials plan for drought. Funding for her project was abruptly cancelled in 2017. Dr. Redsteer resigned shortly afterwards. Now the Biden administration finds itself confronting the mega drought in the southwestern United States, as well as pressure to address the effects of climate change on tribal nations. Dr. Redsteer said no one had been hired to continue her work.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Early September, Guinea's special forces, trained by the United States Army, took control of the country, detaining the President Alpha Conde and suspending the constitution. Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a program which gives you an incisive analysis on events taking place in Africa. Now this week we are focusing on the recent military coup in mineral-rich Guinea, amid reports of U.S. and French connection to the coup. In the second segment of our program, we shall discuss Uganda's move to ban export of raw materials to boost local industries. Stay with us.
U.S.-French connection in Guinea coup. On the 5th of September, Guinea's special forces took control of the country, detaining the president, Alpha Conde, and suspending the constitution. Coup leader, Lieutenant Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya, announced the next day that a new administration of national union would be formed. Guinea's new military rulers have held consultations with political, business and religious leaders. The purpose, they say, is the formation of a transitional government following the coup. Mekale Kamara of the Front for National Alliance, participated at one of the dialogue sessions, which she said focused on reconciliation.
The political parties promised their support because when Guinea is concerned, everyone has to toe the line.
The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has meanwhile imposed sanctions against the military government in Guinea. On a visit to Conakry following the coup, Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara, who was accompanied by Ghanaian President, said they had an excellent meeting with the new military leader. Now, for an incisive analysis on the Guinea coup, we have contacted Nefta Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for joining us. Now, Mr. Freeman, what are the main factors that led to the coup in Guinea?
One is something that's common throughout Africa, is the fact that the people were dissatisfied, and the dissatisfaction of the people was something that the military forces that took over the country used to take over, in terms of, I guess maybe they even shared their satisfaction. If not, they at least used it as an excuse. So there's widespread dissatisfaction with the fact that the people don't control the economy. There's poverty, the infrastructure is poor. There's also the president, current president Alpha Conde, did something very unpopular when the people was trying to change the constitution so he could run for a third term in 2020. So people didn't like that. And then in response to it, there were a lot of demonstrations that were attacked by the state. This brutally attacked, and a lot of people were killed.
Thanks for that, Mr. Anafta Freeman.
The Guinea coup leader, Lieutenant Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya, was trained by the United States Armed Forces. He also served the French Foreign Legion in Afghanistan and Ivory Coast and completed the commando training course in Israel. According to witnesses, U.S. Marines in Guinea's capital, Conakry, were seen celebrating the fall of President Condé, and reports started spreading out their possible involvement in the coup.
The coup leader in Guinea served in the French Foreign Legion and was trained in the U.S. and Israel. Is there more to this coup than meets the eye?
Well, I think the broader context in Africa is the more that meets the eye. A lot of people don't know how extensive the French military is in the continent of Africa, and also AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command militarism. And so these trainings really are almost, they're like the only thing really that the Western countries have to offer, not just the trainings, the militarism that's claimed to be fighting terrorist extreme terrorism, is not doing so really, and it's actually even exacerbating it. There's that. There's also the fact that AFRICOM and even the French are really concerned about China and China's influence in the continent of Africa. And actually, most of these coups in West Africa have taken place in countries where China has heavy influence, investments. And the Israel and the U.S. And French share this animosity, this new Cold War with China.
Now, Guinea has the largest untapped iron ore reserves in the world, and it's also the world's second largest bauxite producer. Prices for aluminium ore and bauxite from this country hit their highest in almost 18 months in top metals consumer China early September, as buyers worried about supply after a coup in this West African country.
Around 50% of China's bauxite supply comes from Guinea, making it China's number one source of the mineral. Mining executives in the country said they were reassured after meeting Lieutenant Colonel Doumbouya. One of the mining executives speaks here after the meeting.
We discussed the difficulties we face on the mining sites, the challenges and opportunities in the mining sector that the Guinean people expect following discussions with the CNRD. The CNRD officials have reassured us a lot, and we are proud of this. It must be said that this coup d'etat is the first in Guinea, after which we have continued our activities. We are living reassured by the new Guinean authorities.
The latest coup in Guinea and the reaction of the Economic Community of Western African States to suspend the country's membership have yet again demonstrated the ineffectiveness of the regional body in enforcing the rule of law in the region. It also raises questions about the commitment of its member states to comply with its protocols. Ghana's president and ECOWAS chair, Nana Akufo-Addo, spoke during the regional emergency summit on the political situation in Guinea and expressed confidence that the body will be able to solve the crisis.
We are required to take informed decisions on these matters that will have long-term consequences for the stability and the defense of the democratic values of our region.
Now, ECOWAS and the African Union have suspended Guinea's membership after the coup, but experience has shown that such action is not stopping coups in Africa. What needs to be done to rectify the situation?
ECOWAS didn't do anything when Alpha Condé and others, Ouattara and Ivory Coast, wanted to change their constitutions, you know. So there's a lot of, if we were talking about democracy and good governance, if it's a people-centered, a human rights defined thing, ECOWAS would fall very short in being able to secure these things. So I'm not sure it really can. There are leaders from various countries, all of which mostly are wed to a global economy that's dominated by the Western powers, and to the extent that they look to anything else, it's still a very capitalist, you know, controlled country where people are experiencing widespread poverty, and lack of control, austerity, all of these things. The International Monetary Fund and the IMF still control, so ECOWAS is fine with all of these things. And so being such, you know, it'll still have to, it's really actually still facilitating a legacy of colonialism and neocolonialism.
Now, there is concern that the military takeovers in Mali, Chad, and Guinea might embolden military officers in regional countries where governments have staved off major opposition movements, coup attempts, and army mutinies in recent years. Now, our last question to you, Mr. Freeman. Do you think militaries in fragile regional countries might be tempted to overthrow civilian governments following successful coups in Mali and Guinea?
This could happen. I mean, I think the militarization of the continent, which is very intense, it's like the people have to really understand that even AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command, which is more widespread than any other Western military and any military in the world in Africa, is in 53 of the 54 countries in Africa, with the exception of Eritrea. There is some sort of command, some kind of thing there, and that even with and France also shoring up its military relationship. So this is has the effect of creating sort of it can have the effect of creating an emboldened military class that really could see no benefit and taking the orders of very unpopular, long-standing, you know, civilian, you know, led government dictators, so to speak, by a lot of people. And so it could lead to that. We're still too soon to say also what's behind some of these things. We don't really even know if some of these coups could be even orchestrated by CIA or MI6 intelligence operations. We don't know. And it's not unlikely. It's not, you know, something unlikely.
Well, there you have it. There is likelihood that the military takeovers in Africa are orchestrated by Western spy agencies such as the American Central Intelligence Agency, CIA. What do you think about that? Let us know through our social media handle. Now, we now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall talk about Uganda's move to ban export of raw materials. Stay with us.
Uganda bans export of raw materials.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The Ugandan government has banned exportation of raw materials to encourage adding of value on all raw materials before exporting them. Now, the country's Minister for Trade, Harriet Ntembazi, says 69% of raw materials in the country are exported, hence causing revenue loss, adding that the ban will encourage adding of value on all raw materials before exporting them.
Uganda mostly exports agricultural products, which account to nearly 80% of the total exports. The country's most important exports include coffee, tea, cotton, tobacco, copper, oil, and fish.
Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni has also on several occasions reiterated on the importance of value addition to the country's agricultural commodities and minerals.
We are exporting copper, 94 degrees pure, then importing more refined copper, 99.9%, to make the copper, to the cables and the transformers and so on. This time with Kiremba, I have insisted anybody who comes there must purify to 99.9 degrees, what they call cathode.
Well, to get an insight into Uganda's move to ban export of raw materials, we have contacted Mr. Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist and a trade policy analyst at Southern Eastern Africa Trade Information and Negotiations Institute in Uganda. Now, our first question to you, Mr. Kiiza, is the ban of export of raw materials the right decision at this time in Uganda?
Yes, the proposed ban on export of raw materials is very important. It comes at a time when government of Uganda and Africa are in high gear towards the industrialization drive. For a long time, Africa has been locked in primary commodity dependence, especially exports of raw materials to the global north, to feed the industries of the global north. And this has not supported the industrialization. Actually, this has locked Africa in a perpetual position where she is just inserted into the global economy as a lower value chain actor, as a supplier of raw materials. So yes, at a time when Uganda and Africa are trying to create jobs, trying to increase on their competitiveness in the global economy, then the drive for industrialization is critical, and this can only be achieved through imposing bans on exports of raw materials.
Thank you for that, Mr. Kiiza.
The Minister of Trade, Harriet Ntembazi, says the Trade Ministry has negotiated a $29 million loan from development partners and sourced another $29 million given to the Uganda Development Bank. This cash is expected to boost the production capacity of local industries this financial year. Does Uganda have the necessary policies in place to boost industries and produce products that can compete globally?
In terms of policy space, we do not have the policy space, and I'm actually surprised that the minister is saying this, because we have given away every policy space in trade agreements with countries, with economies like the EU, but these trade agreements actually make it hard, if not impossible, for countries like Uganda to be able to impose taxes and tariffs on exports of raw materials. Because under, for example, the Economic Partnership Agreement, which is a free trade agreement that we've negotiated with the EU, it ensures that African countries should not impose any taxes on raw materials.
There is concern that the raw material export ban in Uganda might not benefit all farmers. For instance, cotton farmers in some parts of the country are bothered by the uncertainty about weather and prices for their produce. Yet, despite these adversities, a determined cotton farmer in Uganda says he will keep trying.
I have grown up planting cotton. It provides for me. I just can't leave it. I will give it one more season. If it fails, I will only reduce on what I plant.
How will value addition of Ugandan agricultural commodities improve the lives of peasant farmers?
To impose taxes on raw material exports is very critical, because because it helps farmers in terms of boosting their climbing on the global value chains and especially boosting their domestic value chains. Over the time, we have seen a robbing of farmers in terms of locking them down the level of supply and producers of raw materials, which have enriched the industries of the global north to the extent that our industries have ended up collapsing. It is not uncommon to see the leather industry, the textile industry, and for example, even the fish industry collapsing in Uganda when our exports of raw materials in terms of cotton, in terms of fish, raw fish, have been increasing over time. So in terms of fair prices, in terms of getting value out of their products, in terms of reducing the financial hemorrhage, but also, most importantly and critically, in terms of achieving a structural and inclusive industrialization agenda, this move is very important in terms of farmers being supported to be able to increase on their competitiveness, their productivity, and also in terms of their access to competitive markets at the higher end of the value chain.
Now, as Africa confronts the challenges of a global economy, it is being forced to make tough choices in negotiating new trade agreements with its major trading partners, particularly the European Union and the U.S. Now, Mr. Kiza, you earlier talked about how Uganda's trade agreements with the West are an impediment to industrialization in this country. Now, is the situation similar in other African countries?
These trade agreements have contributed a lot in locking us out of competitive value chains. When you look at, for example, reciprocal free trade agreements we have negotiated with the European Union, including AGOA, which is just a preferential market access, they are insisting on ensuring that Africa does not, for example, impose tariffs on exports of raw materials. So this continues to grant Europe, for example, continued and unhindered access of raw materials from Africa. When you look at the case of coffee under AGOA, Africa is only allowed to export green coffee beans to the United States, explicitly stated in the AGOA text. So that locks Africa out of the chances of adding value onto coffee. So in able to be able to have a transformative industrialization agenda, we need to rethink some of these policies.
Very unfortunate indeed there that trade agreements with Western countries are a hindrance to the successful industrialization of African countries. Now, before we wind up today, we also have an exclusive interview with Joel Epe-Mandengu, a Cameroonian comic book author and stand-up comedian. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, first, tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Sure. I am Joel Epe-Mandengu. My artist name is Alliance. I am a Cameroonian artist doing comics, stand-up, comedy show, and I'm also a director of festival. I've created a festival about comics. And finally, I'm a curator on comics exhibitions.
Okay, now, why did you choose the art of comics to convey your thoughts and emotions?
Let's say that since I was little, I started watching cartoons when I was like 6 months. And that was pretty young. And I really, really loved and enjoyed watching things that were drawn and animated. And later on, I wanted to do it myself or by myself. So I did my first comic books at the age of 7. I did the cover and everything when I was 9 years old. And later on, I did studies on comics. I still had, at the core, I desired to do animated series, but when I did the studies on comics, I fell in love with the way you can tell stories and convey emotions through images, not animated images, but you know, drawn images on papers, and this relationship that you can have with the people reading, the readers, is something precious that I don't leave the same with people watching animated series.
Now, what kind of stories do you narrate in your works usually?
Let's say that I have a very wide, I have diverse themes that I use in my comic books. With the Diary of a Bandota, which is the most popular comic that I do. I talk about the life of an African lady who lives out of her country, out of her continent, in Belgium, where she speaks French, but not French like Belgian people, and even Belgian people don't speak French like people from France. So I really try to talk about how you encounter other people who don't share the same culture and who in appearance have the same language as you, but in the details are very different from you.
Now, finally, tell us about the Afropolitan Comics and the idea behind it.
Sure. Afropolitan Comics is an exhibition that anyone can find on the internet. It's online. It's free. It's a free access exhibition that I did with curators from South Africa, Tara Weber and Ray Witcher, with also a French curator, Jean-Philippe Martin, from the City of Comics of Angoulême. And we really wanted to do a 16 authors from Africa exhibition, showing what the continent had, you know, to show to the world. Because when we think of Africa, many still have nowadays very funny ideas about the continent, or they think of the continent as a whole and they don't really see the countries and the diversities of the people living in the country. So with Afropolitan Comics, that's the reason why it's called Afropolitan. We are showing what the authors on the continent can present to the world, which are contemporary pieces of art.
That was Joelle, a Cameroonian comics author and stand-up comedian. Well, and that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. We hope you enjoyed the show. It will be great hearing from you. Goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Danny Sriskandaraja, chief executive of Oxfam, said net zero targets are vital to tackling climate change. Some governments and companies are taking bold action to cut greenhouse gas emissions, but there are currently too few to give us a realistic chance of averting climate catastrophe and the widespread hunger and devastation that come with it. We have prepared for you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, Oxfam Warns Reforestation Hopes Threaten Global Food Security. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Charity Oxfam has warned governments and businesses hoping to plant trees and restore forests in order to reach net zero emissions must sharply limit such efforts to avoid driving up food prices in the developing world. According to a report titled Tightening the Net, Net Zero Climate Targets, Implications for Land and Food Equity, planting trees has been mooted as one of the key ways of tackling the climate crisis. But the amount of land needed for such forests would be vast, and planting even a fraction of the area needed to offset global greenhouse gas emissions would encroach on the land needed for crops to feed a growing population. At least 1.6 billion hectares of land, an area five times the size of India, equivalent to all the land now farmed on the planet, would be required to reach net zero emissions for the planet by 2050 via tree planting alone. While no one is suggesting planting trees to that extent, the report's author said it gave an idea of the scale of the planting required and how limited offsetting should be if food price rises are to be avoided. Nafkoti Dabi, climate policy lead at Oxfam and co-author of the report, explained, "It is difficult to tell how much land will be required as governments have not been transparent about how they plan to meet their net zero commitments. But many countries and companies are talking about afforestation and reforestation, and the first question is, where is this land going to come from?" According to some estimates, food prices could rise by as much as 80% by 2050 if offsetting emissions through forestry is overused. About 350 million hectares of land, an area roughly the size of India, could be used for offsetting without disrupting agriculture around the world. But taken together, the plans for offsetting the countries and companies around the world could soon exceed this. Nafkoti Dabi said, "Already hundreds of millions of people around the world are going hungry. We need to consult countries on how they're going to use their land, and countries and companies need to reduce their emissions first before relying on offsetting. We also need to reduce emissions from agriculture, which is the second biggest source of emissions globally." Report also found that two of the most commonly used offsetting measures, that is reforestation and the planting of new forests, were among the worst at putting food security at risk. According to the analysis, far better were nature-based solutions that focused on forest management, agroforestry, the practice of combining crop cultivation or pasture with growing trees, as well as pasture management and soil management in croplands. These would allow people to use the land for food while sequestering carbon. Darby explained, "We are not against afforestation and reforestation, and we do not want to stop people doing these things, but they should not be used at a large scale and should be combined with other methods, such as agroforestry." She gave the example of Switzerland, which is planning to offset about 12.5% of its greenhouse gas emissions through carbon credits from projects in other countries, including Peru and Ghana. Oxfam estimated to reach that target would take an area the size of Costa Rica. Some companies are also planning to use carbon offsetting based on trees and land as part of their efforts to reach net zero emissions. Oxfam found that many of these plans, taken together, could amount to an overuse of land. For instance, four leading energy companies would require an area twice the size of the United Kingdom for their offsetting. According to Oxfam's estimates, Shell would need about 28.6 million hectares of land by 2050, while Total Energy plans to offset about 7% of its emissions, needing about 2.6 million hectares of land by 2050. Eni, another energy company, has plans for 8 million hectares of forestry, but Oxfam calculates that double this could be needed. BP has not set out its plans in detail, but Oxfam estimated it's likely to require as much as 22.5 million hectares of land for offsetting as much as 15% of its emissions. Danny Sriskandaraja, chief executive of Oxfam, called for companies and governments to cut their emissions drastically rather than relying on offsets. He said, too many companies and too many governments are hiding behind a smokescreen of net zero emissions to continue dirty business as usual activities. A prime example of the doublethink we're seeing is the oil and gas sector trying to justify its ongoing extraction of fossil fuels by promising unrealistic carbon removal schemes that require ludicrous amounts of land. He added, net zero targets are vital to tackling climate change. Some governments and some companies are taking bold action to cut emissions, but there are currently too few to give us a realistic chance of averting climate catastrophe and the widespread hunger and devastation that come with it. A spokesperson for British Petroleum BP said, BP does not intend to rely on offsets to meet either our 2025 emissions reduction targets or 2030 aims. However, they may help us to go beyond those aims if we can. We do support the use of carbon offsets or credits by companies, countries and society to achieve faster and lower cost pathways to net zero emissions and help meet the Paris climate goals. Shell said it did not recognize Oxfam's estimates. A spokesperson said meeting a net zero target requires fundamentally changing the forms of energy Shell supplies and then using offsets at the margin to compensate for any remaining emissions. That is, we're changing the products that we sell. The spokesperson for Shell added, as Shell shifts its portfolio to more and more renewable and low-carbon sources of energy, it could well be that the emissions associated with energy sold by Shell in 2050 is less than the quantity of carbon credits we expect to be able to supply our customers in 2030.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Afghanistan's Deputy Minister of Information and Culture, Zabihullah Mujahid, says the United States has violated the country's airspace by its drones. He accused Washington of violating all international law, as well as a U.S. Taliban peace deal signed between the two sides. He said the violations must be controlled and prevented.
Daesh presence in Afghanistan is not a big headache for us. Our forces are capable to uproot them here without receiving any foreign support. So the U.S. must honor Doha deal and stop violating our space.
Mujahid's statement followed remarks by Pentagon spokesman John Kirby. He said the U.S. retained all necessary authorities to execute over-the-horizon counter-terrorism operations. Kirby also said Washington remains confident in its capabilities moving forward without speaking to specific rules of engagement surrounding airstrikes. He said there is currently no requirement to clear airspace with the Taliban. Analysts say since the U.S. did not fulfill its commitments to Afghanistan over the past 20 years, it is not expected to honor other pacts like U.S.-Taliban Doha deal.
Violating Afghanistan's sovereignty is not a new move by the U.S. It has repeatedly broken its promises, mainly when it comes to respecting our country's sovereignty, even during the rule of former governments here.
Given the U.S. is insisting on continuation of drone strikes in Afghanistan without coordination with the Taliban, the group has also warned the U.S. of negative consequences of continuing violation of Afghanistan's airspace. The U.S. claims that it targets terrorist groups like Daesh with its airstrikes. However, evidence on the ground shows that innocent Afghans are usually the real victims of such attacks. One of the last U.S. drone strikes was in Kabul on August 29 and killed 10 members of a family, including 6 children. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Just above the iceberg on how humiliatingly the Taliban defeated the U.S. in Afghanistan's battlefield. The Pentagon now has finally made admission of its failures, which enabled the Taliban to take over the entire Afghanistan so swiftly.
We need to consider some uncomfortable truths, that we didn't anticipate the snowball effect caused by the deals that the Taliban commanders struck with local leaders in the wake of the Doha Agreement, and that the Doha Agreement itself had a demoralizing effect on Afghan soldiers. And finally, that we failed to grasp that there was only so much for which and for whom many of the Afghan forces would fight. The fact that the Afghan army that we and our partners trained simply melted away, in many cases without firing a shot, took us all by surprise.
If today the world needs to know why the Taliban are back in power, all the world has to do is do a deep analysis of why 300,000 well-equipped Afghan army give up without a fight.
Contrary to what Pentagon admitted before the U.S. Senate Armed Service Committee, as many as 22 Republican senators introduced a bill in the Senate to probe the role of regional countries with particular focus on Pakistan in the military defeat of U.S.-led NATO troops in Afghanistan. The bill proposes sanctions on regional countries, particularly Pakistan and nascent Taliban government in Kabul. After Afghanistan, Pakistan has suffered the most. Tens of thousands of people died. An estimated $250 billion losses occurred to the economy in the long-drawn retaliatory insurgency in Pakistan for supporting a U.S. war on Afghanistan.
The only reason we suffered so much was because we became an ally of the U.S., of the coalition, in the war against Afghanistan, where there were attacks being conducted from Afghan soil into Pakistan. At least there should have been a word of appreciation. But rather than appreciation, imagine how we feel when we are blamed for this, the turn of events in Afghanistan.
Pakistan sounded disappointed with what it called the ungratefulness of the West for ignoring its sacrifices in a war which people here always believed was not their war. Analysts believe that Islamabad is likely to get further closer to China and become part of the efforts to build up a bloc of regional countries in the event of U.S. economic sanctions on Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
It was the biggest state intervention in the UK's labor market since World War II, introduced 18 months ago to help firms weather the economic storm whipped up by the pandemic. Popularly known as the furlough scheme, it's cost a whopping $94 billion. Without it, there are concerns that the job market will be flooded as job seekers need to find employment.
The young people in particular not doing well in this, but anybody on the borderline of low-paid jobs or into welfare benefit or an element of welfare benefit in their income, they are going to be hit very, very badly indeed.
Launched in March last year, the scheme was the brainchild of British Chancellor Rishi Sunak, covering 80% of a furloughed employee's wages. When it started, it helped save more than 11 million jobs. 18 months later, it was still supporting well over a million of them. The government is hopeful that the more than a million job vacancies will absorb workers coming off furlough. Critics say the decision to wind up the scheme will only intensify Britain's economic woes.
And there's going to be about 1.6 million people who are going to be unemployed, losing their jobs. And they will not be able to find jobs necessarily in other sectors of the economy. There are several reasons for that. Partly there's a lack of skills matching, and also because the conditions of the virus have taught people how bad so many of the jobs were. They were not full-time jobs. They were temporary, insecure, low-paid jobs. And a lot of people do not want to go back to those situations.
But it's not just the ending of the furlough that is a concern among Britons. A temporary increase in welfare payments, universal credit, and a moratorium on evictions for renters squeezed by the pandemic are also ending in October, at a time when consumers are facing a 12% rise in energy costs.
And all of that happening at a time when the country's economic recovery from COVID-19 is faltering, as announced by the Bank of England's governor just this week. And what that means for the people in Britain is that an autumn storm is on the way. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The funeral prayers for one of the eight members of the Islamic movement killed by the Nigerian security forces was attended by aggrieved members. The movement said the eight were cut down and killed when security operatives opened fire with live rounds during a peaceful trek of the Arba'in, an annual religious event undertaken by members of the Islamic movement.